Okay, it's my great pleasure to introduce Tom Washon here with us today. Tom, we appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to talk with us. How are you doing?
Sharon, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to discuss some of these points because there's a whole lot of confusion out there in the industry with regard to equipment and what's right and what's wrong for various golfers.
Definitely. I think that's a mild understatement. A lot of people are very, very confused these days, so we're looking forward to your answers about it. Before we get started, can you tell us a little bit of background about yourself and your time in the golf industry?
Yeah, I'm getting to be a little bit long in the tooth these days, seeing as how I'm 57 now. Started out after I got out of college. I joined the PGA program and became a member of the PGA while I was working as an assistant pro, and basically because in those days, back in the early 70s, I made the grand salary of $300 a month as an assistant pro, and the golf course that I first worked at didn't have a full driving range, so to supplement my income, I got really hooked into doing club repair, and that's what really got me going. And back in those days, so it was all reshafting and refinishing wooden woods and all that. And from there, I really got fascinated about making my own clubs. So I built and made all my own routers and boring machines, and made, on a very limited basis, a small line of woods, that I sold. And just really from that, it just springboarded into being fascinated with why some things work for some golfers and others didn't. And whenever I'd try to call people with shaft companies and golf club companies, and nobody would answer my questions, so it got really frustrating. So that just started what's been a lifelong quest to figure out as much as I could about how golf clubs work, and then how they work for different people, from that standpoint. So from going on from, starting as an assistant pro, I went to work as vice president for the Golf Works from 1980 to 86, then got an opportunity to take over as president of Diacraft Golf Products, and did that from 86 to 93, and then the guys down at Golfsmith wanted to upgrade everything, and so I was vice president at Golfsmith and in charge of the component division for them from 93 to late 2001, and then decided finally, probably a little too late, I decided it was time to do my own thing. And so Mary Ellen and I decided to start Washon Golf. We opened the doors in February of 2003 here in Durango, Colorado. And that's what we're working hard to do right now, to really take custom club fitting and increase its awareness among as many golfers as we can.
That's really interesting. Now, throughout all that stuff that you've done, what's been the most rewarding part of your career?
When I look back on it, I really enjoyed writing, as a form of educating. All the writing that I would do primarily, from when I started working at Golf Works through my years at Dynacraft and my years at Golfsmith, most of that was books that were done to educate the club makers, make them a lot more aware of, what goes on at when club head meets ball, and then to write a lot about club fitting as a result of all the research that I've done on an ongoing basis over the years to try and figure out what works for what golfers and why. From that, that's been a lot of fun. But I would say most recently here, when I got the opportunity in 2005 to finally write a book for regular golfers, that was a big thing for me. I had tried to push that and ask for that and get permission to do that when I was a golfsmith, and they didn't want that done, so I had to wait until I got an opportunity to do it with my own company. And the reaction of golfers, that have read one of the two search books, or the 12 Myths, or the one that just came out last week, the Right Sticks book, getting the emails and the phone calls from golfers who were thrilled to learn this information, and just had their eyes opened, finally, to realize that what they've been looking at all these years was nothing more than a standard size, one size fits all, to be bought off the rack, and to learn about how custom fitting really could help them. And then, for in a lot of cases, to hear from many of them after they went through the fitting process, and how thrilled they were, and glad that I'd put the book out so that it opened their eyes. That's been really very, very rewarding for me, to be able to reflect on that, because in a very small way, we've had a little bit of an impact on the industry there. No one had ever come along and done anything to custom fitting. And while what's come from the search books is, you know, a trickle, you know, it does make me realize that, gee whiz, if there was some way we could get this information to, you know, a million golfers, we could really change the industry in that, because the information in the books is good. It's not self-promoting or anything in any way. It just simply says, this is what works, this is why, you know, and this is what you need, you know, if you're this type of golfer, you know, with that. And people are ready for that information. I know the reaction from the readers has been, you know, really fantastic, because, you know, a little more than a month after the first search book came out, we started to see this steady flow of emails and phone calls coming in here from regular golfers who'd bought the book and read it. The light bulb went off over their heads, and they were calling in to try and see, could we help them find a good club maker in their area? And then we started to hear from club makers, you know, who call up and they'd order some products, and, you know, and they'd happen to say, hey, by the way, this, you know, I'm ordering these for a fitting for a guy who just walked in out of nowhere with your book in his hands. So, yeah, granted, it's just a trickle, but if there was some way that we could really get this message out, you know, and get more and more golfers to read some of this information, they're ready for it. You know, they want to find a little different way to do things from the standpoint of their equipment, so that they have more confidence that their money was well spent.
Definitely. I know I'm one of the many readers of your book, and it was, without a doubt, one of the most eye-opening experiences for me about golf equipment, and I learned quite a bit about it. And I'd also like to give you a little plug for the new book, which I just ordered last night, which is called The Right Sticks, Equipment Myths That Could Wreck Your Golf Game. So I think if you like the perfect, search for the perfect golf club, I imagine that would be right up our alley, right?
Yeah, the right stick's got it. You know, I mean, it's funny how quickly things change in the industry. And from, you know, 2005 when I did the first search book to now, there have been a few things that have changed. And so there's a little bit of new information, but by and large, Kieran, you know, I keep trying to, the publisher likes what I do. The bookstores like what I do because it sells, you know. So for them, it's all about money. For me, it's more about having the chance to educate. So, yeah, the books basically, you know, are like a broken record. You know, they keep talking about why custom fitting is better than standard off the rack, and it gives examples, you know, in specific parts of each person's bag, you know, with that. But it's important because this is the only way that I have, you know, to be able to get this message out. And, you know, this is a good opportunity with the Right Sticks book. This actually came about because the buyers for Borders and Barnes & Noble contacted our publisher, and they asked me to write a specific book in a specific format. You know, the internet is huge today. The bookstores are scared of it because people, you know, get a lot of their instant information from the web. You know, there aren't quite as many people who sit down to read 300 or 400 page books anymore like they used to be. So they wanted me to do a book that would be short, you know, covering different topics, no topic covered in more than about 3, 4, or 5 pages, so people could get this kind of same instant information that they're getting off the internet. And so I agreed to do the book, and supposedly the bookstores are going to be promoting this book a little bit more. So for me, it's all about how many more golfers can I get this message to? Because if I get this message into the minds of the majority of golfers, are going to listen to it and say, hey, that makes sense. That makes total sense. This is what I need to do the next time I head out to look for, you know, for new golf clubs.
Definitely. I know we'll all be looking forward to that. We appreciate your honesty about that. Now, what about your career has been the most frustrating part?
Oh, no question. The roadblocks that have been put up to the search books. You know, I've been on the Golf Digest technical panel since 1994. I've got a really close relationship with the equipment writers for all the different Golf Digest magazines. When the first search book came out, they popped it in there. They put it in there and the whole thing. And then from that, I had an opportunity. We did this little booklet called 12 Myths That Could Wreck Your Golf Game. The reason we did that was so that the club makers could have something that was very cheap and inexpensive that they could give away to golfers. See, the main search book was 288 pages and was, you know, too expensive for club makers to buy a bunch of and give away, you know, at $20 a pop. So we created this little 12 Myths booklet, which was key excerpts from the search book. And, you know, we were selling it to the club makers for like 70, 75 cents at our cost just so they could give it away. And the more 12 Myths booklets they give away, the more fittings that they could potentially see. So the guy who was the head of the Golf Digest website at the time, this was back in 2006, was a guy I'd known. He'd been a journeyman writer for him, and, you know, and I gave him a copy of 12 Myths. He got back to me and said, this is great stuff. He said, can you put this on audio? You know, can you read these 12 Myths, and we'll put them on our website? I said, sure thing, you know. So I did, you know, sent him the files and kept looking on their website and didn't see it, you know, then sent him an email, didn't hear back, and finally, you know, many weeks later, I got an email from the guy from his home email address, not his Golf Digest address. And long story short, the 12 Myths audio files had gone up on their website for one day, or part of one day. Two phone calls came in from two of the very large companies who basically said, if you keep these up, you won't see any more ad dollars coming from us. And so, you know, this guy got reprimanded big time for putting the 12 Myths up on the website by the high-ups with the magazine. Long story short, it caused him to get really frustrated, and 7-8 months later, he quit after 15 years with the magazine because he was so disappointed that good information like this got shut down from going to the golfers simply because two companies who buy millions and millions of dollars worth of ads with Golf Digest and Golf World said, get rid of it or you can kiss our ad dollars goodbye. So, you know, it told me that, you know, some people out in the industry don't want this information to be known, you know, with that. And since that time, I probably, in bringing out the other books, have maybe had one or two other blurbs in the major magazines about my books. The other ones just ignore it because they're a little bit afraid, you know. And off the record, they tell me, you know, we can't put your stuff up, Tom, because it's going to upset too many people who control too much revenue for our magazine. So I got to say, that's the number one most frustrating thing that we've experienced, is here's some really good information that's going to help a lot more golfers potentially make better buying decisions, and there's a whole bunch of people who don't want that information to be heard.
Definitely. I know that's really unfortunate, but part of what we can do here is get you a little bit more exposure about it, and so we're excited to hear about what you have to say. Now, can you talk about some of the influences you've had in your career, some of the people who've influenced you?
Yeah, most definitely one of the things that really got me switched on about, you know, really digging into learning how things work was when I got my first copy of The Search for the Perfect Swing by Alistair Cochran and John Stobbs. This was two English guys, you know, who wrote the book in 1968 that really began the very, well, I gotta say, Search for the Perfect Swing was the trigger that made the golf industry really start to look at engineering their designs instead of just putting on another club that had a different color face insert or a different shape sole plate or a different color of stain on the wooden head, you know, with things like that. And that was, you know, I lived, ate, and breathed everything in that book, you know, and that really triggered me with that. That was definitely a giant influence, you know, for me. The other one was, I didn't come out of college with a formal degree in engineering. Everything that I've learned from an engineering and science and physics background, I've learned along the way. So I've always learned that there are a lot of people out there who have knowledge that if I can turn it in the right direction, they can help me learn a lot more too. And so there have been a couple of people during my career, you know, that I've been able to consult with and who have mentored me. Wasn't the case that they knew everything about golf per se, but they knew the science, and between me and them to adapt the science in the right direction, you know, then that helped really open the doors for really looking at a lot of this stuff that we now know and bringing it up and verifying it, you know, through a very scientific means. And that's been a huge help to me over my life, you know, because I realize that I don't know everything and I need to go out and get some help to be able to dig in the right area to come up with the right answers.
Right. Very interesting. Now, how has the golf equipment landscape changed in the past 10 years? Are clubs really becoming that much more forgiving? Because even though we're seeing new changes in clubs, radical designs, we're not seeing the average handicap drop by very much. So exactly what effect is it having?
Yeah, the biggest reason why all the, you know, and let me put it this way, you know, I mean, science really began in the golf club business in the late 60s, early 70s. You know, it basically started when Carsten Solheim and a handful of other people recognized that investment casting was a good way to make club heads. You know, that opened the door for being able to change centers of gravity more in club heads. It opened the door for being able to make cavity backs to get more perimeter weighting for more off-center hit forgiveness. And that really triggered the, you know, the advent of real engineering science, you know, into the golf industry. Now, if you say over the last 10 years, now we're going back to 1998, and 1998 happens to be the year that the USGA enacted the rule that put a limit on the coefficient of restitution of club faces. You know, that began this whole thing of, and I'm sorry if people don't agree with me, but it was the USGA's paranoia that's really had an effect. You know, first came the COR rule, then came the rule limiting the size of heads to 470 cc's and various dimensional requirements. Then you had the limit on the length of the club. Then you had the limit on the moment of inertia. And now we're looking at rules that potentially could change the scoreline configuration. And really and truly, when you look at these five different rule changes as they've come about, there was no scientific testing done by the United States Golf Association to find out what the effects of a higher COR were. They got paranoid. They looked at all the drivers that were submitted. They said, here's the highest one we've seen so far. We're sticking the limit right there. Boom. They never tested to find out what would be the effect if we did allow this to go up to 0.86 or 0.88. Not one scientific test done that way. Wasn't a test done to determine what would be the effect of a 500 or 600 cc driver head on the game. That wasn't done. There wasn't a test done to determine the effect of a 50-inch driver when they set the limit at 47 or 48, I forget. You know, there was no test done to determine what would a higher and higher and higher moment of inertia do. Then finally, in doing this proposal for the rule change that they're looking at for scorelines, then they finally decided to go do a major, major test to determine the effects. And they found that the scoreline configuration situation only affects the really good ball striker, the really good swing fundamentals, has no effect on the average guy. But yet they're pushing these rules through because they're paranoid about what's going on at the elite level of the game with tour players on this. So that's been a big one. That really has put some limits, you know, on the industry and changed the landscape a little bit over the past 10 years. I think the other thing that's changed in the past 10 years is you've seen we're now at a point where there are five golf club companies who control nearly 80% of the premium golf club business out there. And so that means these five companies, if you add their total sales up, they comprise nearly $4 billion worth of golf equipment sales every year. So when you get to the point where you've got five companies who are averaging around $700 million a year in sales, that means to be able to make their numbers, every single year they got to sell 300,000 or 400,000 drivers, 300,000 or 400,000 fairway woods, 200,000 to 250,000 sets of irons. And so that means when these companies come out and they market on the basis of a new technology, they saturate the market with that technology in 1 year. And so 1 year goes by, they can't get two full years of their required forecast sales out of one new technology anymore. You go back into the 80s and 90s even, and companies could get 2 or 3 years off of a brand new technology. And so here you have the situation where all the marketing which crows about a brand new technology coming out each year, it changes the next year. And I think what it does to at least some golfers out there, it puts the golfers in a situation where they go, wait a minute. You're changing your mind already. You're telling me there's something better than last year and something better than the year before, and it's only 1 year later with this. And then the golfers go out and they buy these things, and the majority don't improve to the level that they think they should based on the ads or the marketing that they read about it. And so I think you're getting a situation now where a lot of golfers are beginning to adopt a little bit of a mindset where they say, hey, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. You know, and I think that that's starting to affect the frequency of buying new equipment among new golfers. I mean, that began 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, certainly this year we're in a little different situation because of the recession, price of gas, you know, daily expenses are going up for all of us, you know, price of real estate going down, you know, and so certainly there's no question that's slowing down, you know, sales in the golf industry. But this whole thing of things beginning to flatten out a little bit, companies not growing quite as fast as they had before, that began 4 or 5 years ago when the product life cycle began to get shorter and shorter. And companies were bringing out brand new things every year, you know, and touting them as being great. So, I, you know, those are big things, you know, that have happened over the last 10 years that I think have left a real impact on the golf equipment industry.
Very cool. Now, you touched on writing the book, The Search for the Perfect Golf Club. And, you know, like you said, it's been a big change in terms of how stuff is marketed and how people look at custom club fitting.
Well, you know, of course, you got to go way back. I go way back, you know, and I've been reading golf magazines all my life. But then as I got to be more and more involved in the golf industry, and as I felt as I was becoming more and more knowledgeable about golf clubs, reading some of the ads or listening to the statements made about golf clubs really got to be frustrating to me. I said, gee, man, you know, I know a lot about golf clubs, and I know this is not completely true, what I'm hearing, but, you know, what about all those millions of golfers who don't know quite as much as I do that are being influenced by this? I said, someday I've got to get the chance to be able to write about golf clubs for consumer golfers so that they can learn more of the truths, you know, of what's going on. As I said, when I was a golfsmith, I begged them to let me do that book. They wouldn't allow me to do that, I think largely because they were building a giant retail division that was making most of its money selling OEM clubs. You know, and I knew the information that I would want to write about to educate golfers probably would fly in the face of that business model. You know, so, but the impetus was just strictly the fact that I knew that people who really don't know or don't have the opportunity to know as much about golf clubs as I do from my work, I really felt that they needed to know some of these truths so that they could go out and make a lot better informed buying decision about their golf clubs, and from that, potentially be able to play a little bit better and enjoy the game a little bit more.
Definitely. I know your book has definitely helped a lot of people do that. And another thing you mentioned was your 12 myths. Is there one mistake that you see most golfers making with their equipment?
Well, the biggest mistake is that, you know, and it's no fault of their own, please. I'm not faulting golfers with this because they can only go in and ask for what they know about. You know, because there has been no real marketing on the basis of how professional club fitting could potentially benefit a wide range of golfers, you know, this is the biggest thing, I think, is the fact that we still sit here and fight a lot about the myth that is perpetuated that says custom fitting is only for good players. I mean, even I just noticed Frank Thomas, who was the technical director for the USGA for 26 years or so, and now he's been on his own for the last several years doing consulting. He's just written a book, and in the book he states in there that standard clubs are fine for all golfers until you get to a point where you're shooting the mid-70s. Well, that's garbage. You know, Frank doesn't know fitting. You know, he's never worked in it. He's never done the research to have his eyes open to see what a shorter length, higher loft, proper face angle, proper total weight, proper shaft can do for an 18 handicap golfer compared to what he bought off the rack standard as advised by some $9 an hour guy who really doesn't know any more than he does about golf clubs. You know, with that. So that, you know, is probably the biggest one, that most people still cling to the myth that, well, I'm not good enough to be custom fit. You know, and that's only for good players. And it's the exact opposite. I mean, I've almost coined a new phrase over the last few years here as I've watched all of this and say that, you know, a golfer's level of improvement and or score improvement is inversely proportional to their handicap when they get custom fit. You know, in other words, we go out and fit a 2, 3, 4, 5 handicapper, you know, and it's pretty rare if from the fitting they actually really lower their score. Now, it can happen definitely with those players if you include wedge and putter fitting, you know, within that, because those clubs affect the score more directly than any of the clubs in the bag. But when you look at the, let's say, 14, 18, 23 handicappers, these are golfers, you know, who regularly get the ball airborne most all the time. They generally make roughly the same mistakes in their swing most of the time. Sure, a lot of people still hook and slice with this, but if you look at all your shot patterns, you do one more than the other, you know, with this. And most all of these people have been buying or playing with clubs that are just standard made. They bought off the rack, and so woods are too long. You know, most of the irons are too low lofted. They've got the wrong set makeup. They definitely don't have their total weight and swing weight matched for their size, strength, athletic ability and swing. You know, you can just go down the list, you know, with all the different ways that you can change things to help offset some of the mistakes that these average players make. And it happens all day long. And I, you know, for years, since I've worked only in this side of the industry, you know, I wish I'd kept track. It'd be a gigantic number of emails, letters, and phone calls from club makers who will relate an experience about taking some average golfer, completely refitting him, and out he goes. He's about 5 or 6 shots better. You know, he only loses one ball a day instead of 3. You know, things like that, which definitely are forms of measurable improvement, you know, for golfers. And it does happen. There's no question about that. So that's probably the biggest myth, you know, that we fight, is just the sheer education of who can benefit and how much, you know, from professional custom fitting.
Very interesting. Now, another hot button issue is the tour versus retail debate. We're wondering if you could get your take on exactly what the differences are between tour.
Well, having had a little bit of experience in my past of creating original club head designs or original, you know, custom fit designs for a handful of tour players, there are some who can play with the stock head that's made to be shafted up in standard form and sold off the rack. You know, in my experience, Bruce Litsky was one of those. You know, we could take a head that we were, you know, that I had created that was a low offset, you know, player's shape, profile, moderate cavity back. He didn't need any variations on the heads. He just needed his shaft, his length, his total weight, his swing weight, etc. You know, for that sort of thing. On the other hand, then you run into people like Scott Verplank and Dane Stewart, who, you know, had to have something made from scratch. Different grind here, different shape on the sweep up the toe, different look for the top line, different look for the bottom of the hosel, different leading edge look, you know, on and on and on, where it had to be, each one had to be hand ground, custom made, you know, until they'd look at it and say, yeah, okay, now put it together with my specs, my shaft, and everything like that. So I also remember back when I was a golfsmith in 98 when we bought Lynx out of bankruptcy, and then the trucks came in and unloaded every one of all the junk and assets and stuff, you know, from having bought Lynx. When I was going through all of, you know, the boxes and boxes of stuff from the R&D side, you know, and all this sort of thing, I'd see molds that were specially made for the Lynx players, heads that had been specially made, you know, for various players that had been on the Lynx staff over years. And on the outside, they sort of looked like what was being sold that particular year off the rack. But when you looked at it, you said, no, that's a different, you know, type of club head, you know, that this guy, you know, insisted that they make just for him. So there are some cases out there where the tour players insist on something that is very different than what the head would be that is built to the standard form to be sold off the rack. Probably more of that, I would say, in my experience, than players who would just take the standard head and, you know, have it built with their shaft and to their specs out there. So those differences do exist, but they only exist for that particular player. You know, that it's not like saying, you know, it's like saying, geez, I love this suit, you know, that Bono, you know, was wearing at this charity event. I got to go buy this exact suit in Bono's size and all that. Well, it doesn't fit you, you know, like that, you know, and it's the same sort of thing, you know, to go out there and buy something that is a tour issue. Well, maybe it isn't what you need, you know, and it won't do you any favors in that. But if it makes your ego feel good, I guess then you spent your money and you got some pleasure from it, you know, right there. So it's really all about the only reason that the tour players ever had special models made for them was because they, and only they, wanted these changes on something that they and only they were going to play in competition out there. And that doesn't mean it's right for, you know, a guy who wants to wave it in front of his playing partners and say, I got the same head that Ernie Els played with. You know, that's dumb.
Very interesting. Now, another thing I remember reading is your advocacy of shorter than stock lengths. Why is it that we're seeing so many OEMs going with long driver lengths, which are approaching almost 46 inches now stock, and stronger lofts, which is based off, you know, 44-degree pitching wedges?
Yeah, most of my focus, Garen, you know, on this thing of the length thing, it falls in the driver and woods area a little bit more than it does in the iron area, although there's a few. Anyway, you go back, there's a definite history for this. You go back into the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, going into that era, or 50s and 60s and before, if you wanted to be a golf club company, you had to be able to make everything yourself. There were no subcontract factories out there to make your heads for you. You had to make your own heads. Now, you could buy the shafts from True Temper, you know, and that sort of thing, and the grips from Golf Pride and all that. But you had to make your own stuff, you know. Now, when investment casting hit the industry, that all changed. A couple of the big golf companies tried to open up their own foundries, and they found that that wasn't very cost-effective unless they could do a whole lot more than just make their own heads with that. So, you know, what evolved then were a series of subcontract factories, investment casting factories, who started to make everybody's heads. You know, once that happened, you didn't have to really be all that knowledgeable, manufacturing-wise, to get into the golf club business. And so when you went in this era, when investment casting took over, the number of golf club companies between the mid-60s and the mid-70s almost tripled. You know, and now, all of a sudden, you had intense competition. And so to try and get themselves above the rest in competition, two things began. One, some of the companies started making their lofts lower because they knew that people would go out, and if they hit this year's model, you know, this year's 5-iron, 10 yards further than last year's 5-iron, they think, hey, that's a better golf club. People didn't know what the loft numbers were on the 5-iron or 6-iron or any of the club heads. So lower lofts, you know, shrinking loft disease, as I call it in my book, that began as a result of all this move into investment casting and the sheer competition that came because of it. Longer lengths was the other one because, see, most of these companies, whenever they go out and create a brand new model, you know, in the old days, a lot of their testing just simply was gather around a whole bunch of good golfers, give them the golf club, you know, get their feedback. Okay, well, good golfers with good swing fundamentals will get a higher club head speed from a longer length shaft. And so somebody got the bright idea, hey, drivers have been 43 inches long forever. Let's make our driver 44. People will hit it further, and they'll love us, and they'll buy our golf clubs. And that began this whole thing with length also. So once the first companies began to increase lengths and decrease loss, every company had to do it. You could not get away with it because, at least in the area of lofts, that was a definite. You start making a 5-iron 28 degrees where you had it 32 before, virtually every golfer is going to hit that further when they make solid contact. Now, the other side of the coin, the longer length driver, that was one that most of the companies didn't understand because they weren't doing any kind of research into fitting. You know, it's really only the golfer with the inside-out path or square path and the golfer with the late wrist cock release who are going to get a higher club head speed from a longer length shaft. And I've done this test twice in my career where you take different length drivers with all different levels of ability of golfers, and that's what we learned from it, was that those golfers who swing a little over the top to a lot over the top and outside in, those golfers who release the wrist cock a little early to a lot early, they don't see higher club head speeds with longer length shafts. You know, and so how many are there like that? There's a whole lot more who have poor swing fundamentals than there are who have good swing fundamentals out there. So that's why I camp on this whole thing about driver length and wood length, because all those, you know, the standard length being 45 to 46 inches with every single company out there for a man's driver it's really hurting the majority of golfers who buy those things off the rack. And that's why we get so many positive reports from club makers when they take these over-the-top outside-in or early-ish release players, get them into something that's like 43.5 or 44, and see that they actually hit the ball on center more often, and they hit it straighter, you know, with that. And yet, you know, nobody questions this, you know, because if it's a big, big company and they're making tons of money and they got tons of players on tour playing this stuff, how can they be wrong? Well, 46-inch drivers don't work for the majority of golfers. And that's, you know, why I camp on that as a big one, because if you do get that change and you are a golfer who is a little over the top to a lot over the top and a little early to a lot early with the release, you will definitely hit the tee ball better with a shorter length driver.
Very interesting. Now, kind of a side note to that, what would happen if all the irons in the set had the same length of shaft?
That's an interesting one. I followed that. There have been discussions on forums, you know, about that sort of thing. It's possible, yeah, most definitely, because when you look at your set of irons and you say, what is it that makes that 10 or 12 or 15-yard difference between each of my irons? Well, 80% of it, 80, 85% of it is the loft change. It's only, you know, 10, 15, maybe 20% of that comes from the length difference change. And actually, with an awful lot of golfers, let me give you an example. You could take, pick any two irons in a set. Take the 7 and 8 iron, okay? Keep those at their actual loft differences, but make both clubs the same length, and you're still pretty much going to hit those two irons pretty close to within a yard, maybe two, of the, you know, of the distance they were when they were a half inch different in length from them, okay? Now, change those lengths by an inch or more, now the length factor starts to come in with an awful lot of golfers out there. You know, with that. So, in theory, it's possible, you know, to go out and build a set of irons so they're all the same length, but you get your distance difference strictly between the lofts. Now, you'd have to, in some cases, the loft increments might be a little different than the typical 3 or 4 degrees to ensure that, but it can be done. Now, there is somewhat of an example in the history of equipment for a company having done that, and we go back into the mid-90s or somewhat late-ish, you know, 96, 97, I think it was, when Tommy Armagoff Company brought out a model called the EQL. And in that model, sold standard off the rack, all the woods were the same length as a 5-wood. All the irons were the same length as a 6-iron. Okay. And in addition to, you know, talking about consistency there, we now know later, you know, that by making all the clubs the same length, you're also making their moment of inertia the same. But they didn't really tout that much back in those days. Anyway, long story short, 6 months later, Armour basically was out of business. And the reasons were twofold. Number one, there were enough golfers who noticed that they couldn't hit the 5-wood as far as they used to hit their old driver. And so that hurt them because everybody wanted to, you know, nobody wants to lose that much distance off the tee, or at least those who do lose the distance and don't like it are very vocal about it. Let me put it that way. And then you had this situation where golfers playing with irons that were all the same length as a 6-iron were starting to have problems with their 9 pitching wedge. Those clubs down there, they hit them too far, or they didn't feel they had the finesse feel to be able to take that long of a length and knock it down into a, you know, a half shot, three-quarter shot, you know, and so they were losing shots around the greens, and they were not patient enough to work with that longer length on their short irons and get used to it, you know. So, and Armour went bankrupt as a result of that one product line, you know, introduction. So I can say, yeah, single-length irons, sure. You know, if golfers very inconsistent with the irons, might be worth an experiment there. But along with that, you may have to be patient with working out the situations that can come along with, like, the 8-9 wedge to be able to...